moved away again after 8th grade, and I did not get boobs in time for high school. Yet looking young, a source of crippling insecurity, was a huge professional asset. My agent was thrilled I wasn't growing. As long as you still look the part, casting directors value a few extra years of experience and maturity, plus child labor laws are more relaxed. Couldn't the kids at school see this was good for my career? A lot of kids I'd met in New York were taking breaks to just be a kid for a while. Were they crazy? I wanted to just be a kid as much as the next guy, but I wasn't about to take a career in the arts for granted. There are only a handful of parts for children on Broadway at any given time, and maybe the paucity of roles should have been a sign that taking a break wouldn't hurt. But I could see a future where I got drunk at office parties and babbled about how I'd been a child star, because my alternate reality self would definitely overstate her former glory. The first thing I booked after High Society was the musical version of Jane Eyre. It was in the workshop phase when the producers assemble a cast and run through the show for a couple of weeks. The idea is to get the show on its feet so that it can be improved before a potential Broadway run. Based on each workshop, the writer, composer, and director will go away and make changes, then do it all again. Sometimes all the actors are rehired. Sometimes they aren't. There was a challenging but thrilling piece of music for young Jane that had made the role difficult to cast. Consequently, I was treated like a bit of a unicorn. The producers sent up prayers in direct opposition to my bathroom stall plea that I would stay the same size. But the show was at least a year away from getting to Broadway. Occasionally, I'd catch the producers tilting their heads at me, gauging my height with an invisible yardstick. I made a point to transition my rehearsal attire from chunky boots to thin-soled ballet flats and ruefully dug out my limited tube vest to look as young as possible. I was with that show for about a year, doing additional workshops or giving special cabaret-style performances to rooms of potential investors. But after a while, a bittersweet atmosphere took hold. There was a consolatory vibe at what would be my last performance, but I didn't know why. I would have recognized the behavior if I'd ever had a boyfriend. I was about to get dumped. I was sad to lose the job. My disappointment was slightly allayed when I heard they'd cut young Jane's song because they couldn't find a replacement to sing it. That might not have been true. The song slowed down the pacing of the first act anyway. This was not the only time I would lose a job this way, but I confess I was grateful for every inch I gained. Finding even one article of adult clothing that fit me seemed a reasonable trade to being fired. Maybe I should have prioritized my professional pursuits, but my home life always felt equally significant. Decorating my locker seemed just as important as getting new headshots. I had to compartmentalize because everyone else did. People at school didn't care that I had an audition for Touched by an Angel, and weirdly, casting directors didn't care that I had a 4-page French assignment or that Courtney from choir was being mean to me for no reason. While I was in one place, I tried not to think about the other. It was sort of like living a double life. Like a spy. Yeah. I was like James Bond. Like loud, unsexy James Bond. MGM, the next time you want to reboot the franchise, you know where to find me. Camp. The summer before my senior year of high school, I went to New York and made a non-union film called Camp. It was a unique film in many ways. People have either never heard of it, or they want to tell me that it changed their life, no matter how inappropriate the circumstances. I am very glad this movie helped you come out to your parents, and as I was saying, my insurance only covers the generic form of Rectagel. Camp was written and directed by Todd Graff based on his real experiences at Stage Door Manor, the infamous children's theater camp in upstate New York. Stage Door is a haven for every young misfit out there who'd just die if they were forced to be in one more school-sanctioned production of Peter Pan. The camp is known for putting on arguably inappropriate shows with its young campers. Imagine The Glass Menagerie or Once on This Island, a musical about tensions between light and dark-skinned Haitians, with an all-white preteen cast. It's not universally relatable material for a movie. Because the movie was replete with song and dance, a month-long rehearsal period was scheduled in Manhattan. Most of the cast members were local, but some of us had nowhere to stay for the duration of rehearsals, so indie production company Killer Films found competitively priced living spaces to accommodate their out-of-town actors. For example, I lived in the walk-in pantry of a small uptown apartment shared by 3 film students. Don't worry, the film students were really nice, and the pantry was mostly empty. I had no complaints. It was summer, I was 16, I got to take the subway to work in the morning and learn music and choreography all day. I was going to internet cafes to check my email, and the film students were explaining things like establishing shots and coverage to me, and I was on my own. The establishing shot is the first shot of a new scene which establishes the location for the audience. You know how on Seinfeld there's always a shot of the exterior of the diner before they cut inside and we see the gang slowly ruining their lives? That's the establishing shot. After the first wide master shot of a scene is done, the subsequent camera angles, close-ups, two shots, etc., are considered coverage. You know the opening sequence of Boogie Nights? It's the opposite of that. So sure, I wasn't really a New York resident, and I wasn't getting paid, but I felt like such a grown-up. Wait till the kids at choir camp hear what I did this summer. Toward the end of the rehearsal period, our choreographer, Broadway legend Jerry Mitchell, stopped us for a pep talk. We were exhausted, and he was about to tell us to get our shit together. He said that whether we liked it or not, this movie was going to be around forever, and that what we put on film in the coming months would, unlike theater, exist long after we were dead. It was super dark and probably should have scared me off making movies forever. What can I say? I was living in a pantry. I was getting yelled at in dance rehearsals. If I wasn't living the dream, I don't know who was. Weirdly, my excitement did not stem from the fact that I was about to be in my first film. I guess, if I'm honest, it didn't feel like we were making a real movie. Real movies had famous actors in them, like Tom Hanks or the German lady from Austin Powers. My metric was all over the place. And films about teenagers had gorgeous, polished 25-year-old actors, and the plots revolved around summer crushes, not going to prom and drag and getting your ass kicked. I don't mean to suggest that I didn't believe in what we were doing. I just couldn't imagine a world where anyone outside the cast was ever going to see it. I knew that tiny films like Clerks or The Blair Witch Project could be huge, but I wasn't sure that musical numbers from Burt Bacharach's Promises Promises or jokes about Stephen Sondheim were going to play wide. I also knew that Killer Films had made dark, important films like Kids and Boys Don't Cry, but again, Promises Promises and Stephen Sondheim. My big problem was Fritzy, a weird girl with greasy hair and terrible clothes who happened to be the character I was playing. Fritzy was the camp loser, and she was obsessed with and probably in love with Jill, the hot popular girl at camp. Today, I would be thrilled to play such a twisted little character. At the time, I just wanted to wear makeup and have my hair done like all the other girls in the cast. I wanted to downplay the ambiguously sexual nature of Fritzy's very much unrequited interest in Jill. I wanted to be likable on screen. I still had to go back to high school once this was over, and I so badly wanted to be the hot girl in a movie. Not the girl who washes the hot girl's underwear by hand. A few years ago, Diane Lane gave an interview where she admitted that she was equally conflicted about one of her first film roles. She played the talentless frontwoman of a rock band in The Wonderful, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains, and she hated that the band was supposed to be terrible. She wanted to be an on-screen rock star. I hear that, sister. 16-year-old insecurity is a real impediment to truth in art. The very first scene on our very first day was a long and complicated tracking shot on the street near the West Side Highway that involved most of the cast. After each take, we'd just stare at each other, waiting to hear if we needed to do it again. I didn't know it then, but that's sort of how it always feels. I heard Todd laugh that the people at Killer Films were going to be pissed when they saw the footage because there was no coverage, and I knew what that meant. That first scene was the only thing we shot in Manhattan, and when we finished, we piled into vans and drove up to a vacant camp in the Catskills, the real stage door manor, where we would shoot the rest of the film. In interviews, lots of actors say that making a movie is like sleepaway camp. They have no idea. There was no phone, no TV, no internet, and no cell phone reception. If you weren't working on a certain day or a certain week, too bad. No one had a car, so you weren't leaving. We got paid $75 a day on the days we worked and only the days we worked. This is why unions matter. The blessing was that the other cast members were wonderful. Without the aid of cell phones, we spent our days off wandering around the camp to see who else wanted to hang out. It was as close as I ever got to having a gang of neighborhood friends like I'd seen in movies from the 90s about growing up in the 70s. Our ages ranged from 12 to 25, and our interests ranged from musical theater to music or theater. We found a few board games in the main offices but got sick of them quickly and spent most of our time engaging in general nerdery. We held Waiting for Guffman trivia competitions and took makeshift dance classes from a cast member who'd obsessively collected bootleg videos of Twyla Tharp shows. Sasha and Tiffany, the two best singers, taught each other riffs and tested them out in parallel harmony while the rest of us listened in disbelief. Casual singing became so normalized that when I went home, it took me weeks to stop peppering my conversations with melodic interludes. I shot my first real scene about a week into our stay. That morning, I got into my awful wardrobe and a woman rubbed down my frizzy hair with fistfuls of men's pomade, and I went to the set, aka, I walked 3 minutes to a different part of the camp. We did a few final rehearsals in the set of Jill's bedroom, and Todd told us we were going to film the next one. Someone yelled last looks, which meant that 3 people came into the room and poked at me. The wardrobe department pulled my sleeves back down to my wrists, the hair department gave me another handful of grease, and the makeup department looked me over to make sure I hadn't secretly applied lip gloss again, like I'd done on the first day. This new ritual of last-minute touch-ups taught me that actors could become unfilmably ugly at any moment and needed to be beautified at 10-minute intervals. At first, it felt like pampering, but very quickly, it became the standard by which I measured how insecure I should feel that day. The scene was really just a conversation between Fritzy, my character, and Jill, the object of her obsession. It was creepy content, but pretty straightforward in terms of filmmaking. Back on the first day in the city, we had filmed the whole scene at once, in an open space with complicated blocking. It had felt like a piece of theater. This was just 2 people in a room talking at each other. Once Jill had been glossed, fluffed, and shimmered, and I'd been, well, greased, we stood on our start marks and waited for action. We did the scene, just like we'd done it in rehearsals, and eventually we heard Todd's voice call cut from the next room. That was it. That was my first time filming a scene in a movie. It might have driven me to distraction had it not been so ordinary. I'd only ever performed in front of an audience before. The audience was a barometer of your success or failure. The audience gave you energy. Their presence filled the room with a kind of electricity that told you, this is it! This is happening! The audience on a film set was just your director and the perpetually bored crew. Filming a movie felt exactly like not filming a movie. I've come to love film sets and see the low-key environment as an asset, but it's still unnerving that you can finish a scene and not know how it went. Things that crack you up while you're filming can go over like a lead balloon in the movie, and things that feel stilted and boring on set can be tense and exciting for a viewer. While you're shooting, you rely on the director to tell you if it's going well, and you have to trust that they're right. With my favorite directors, at least 4 times per shoot, I'll think, that is a fucking terrible idea. Let's do it. I went back to my room and wondered what we'd done. I couldn't ask anyone for advice because none of us had ever been in a movie before. My next scene involved 6 actors and was my first lesson in what it feels like when a scene is not going well. The scene had a fair bit of exposition, a few jokes, and some good old-fashioned bitchy teen drama. In a practical sense, though, it had 6 first-time film actors slogging their way through 2 pages of dialogue. Everyone was making a meal out of their bits, dragging out punchlines, adding overdramatic inflection to minor lines. Todd was getting frustrated. At one point I heard him say, I forgot I'm not working with actors. He didn't mean it as a dig, we were just making mistakes that experienced film actors wouldn't. I thought, yeah guys, come on, we don't need to take these long pauses before every little line. I then proceeded to take a long pause before my one line. Once I recognized that I was a total hypocrite, I started jumping in at warp speed in every subsequent take. It was a little weird, but it was an improvement. Shooting the musical numbers helped bridge the gap between theater and film. We shot them in the various tiny theaters at the camp and performed them exactly like we would have on stage. Okay, this we knew how to do. We happily did them over and over as the cameras were repositioned around the theater. Frisbee's solo number was The Ladies Who Lunch from the musical Company. It's a wildly inappropriate song for a teenage girl and was even more bizarre coming from one with the body of a 12-year-old. This peculiar situation arises in the film because Fritzy has poisoned Jill after being rejected by her and steals the role mid-performance. She then sings a song about the ennui of middle-aged womanhood and her disillusionment with the bourgeoisie who surround her privileged 1970s Manhattan life. Sure. When we finished shooting the number, we were supposed to get a shot of Jill watching me from backstage, furious and still throwing up, but Todd said he was going to scrap it. He whispered to me, "You don't cut away from lightning in a bottle." I'd never heard the expression before. In fact, for years, I thought it was his personal invention. But I knew it meant I had done well. He was the whole audience, so I had to trust him. My mom came to pick me up on the last day of filming. I wept so hard and for so long that she pulled the car over, thinking I was going to need medical attention. I haven't cried at the wrap of a film since. At the time, I couldn't reconcile the fact that no matter what we told each other, I would never go back there, never be with those people ever again. Now, I see catch and release as part of the beauty of what I get to do. Then again, I haven't been stuck on a campground with 20 people and no technology for 2 months since, so maybe it was just the only time I've experienced Stockholm Syndrome. After filming wrapped, I went back to Maine and started the school year. Each time I described it to friends, it felt less and less real. There were no famous actors in it, the plot sounded ludicrous, had no point of reference to give. If High School Musical had already been made, I could have described it as, like High School Musical, but with songs you'll probably hate. I kept my expectations low. 6 months later, I found out the movie had been selected for the Sundance Film Festival. I was over the moon. I couldn't wait to tell people. But I held off. I had to find the right time to announce that the coolest thing that could possibly happen was happening. Before winter vacation, our French teacher had us go around the room and say what we were doing over the break. En français, s'il vous plaît. Well, thank you very much, Madame Cadeau, for this perfect opportunity. I reported my news. No one in the room even blinked. This was French 6. These motherfuckers understood me. Did they really not know what I was talking about? Maine is small, but we're not devoid of culture. What the hell? Why are you not impressed with me? Killer Films booked 3 hotel rooms at the festival, meant for the 3 lead actors only, but everyone else in the movie flew themselves out with the unspoken understanding that we'd all be crashing with them. 3 to a bed, everyone else on the floor. It was glorious. We were gleefully aware of our status as a ragtag non-union group in a sea of real, SAG card-carrying actors. We went to gifting suites that refused to give us anything, reveled in the bright cold holding fancy coffees we had no intention of drinking, and took advantage of the parties by sending one of our legal cast members to the open bar for 7 drinks at a time. I saw Oliver Platt going into his hotel and executed my first and last celebrity approach. Oh my god, you're Oliver Platt. I love you so much in Dangerous Beauty. He smiled and thanked me. I smiled expectantly at him for too long, and eventually he told me to have a nice afternoon and went on his way. It was a strange interaction, and I left it feeling dissatisfied, but not knowing what I'd hoped would happen. I'm terrible in every social situation. I don't know why I thought it would go better with a famous person. I vowed to never approach a celebrity again. On our second day at the festival, we shuffled into reserved seats at the back of the library theater to watch our movie. The film screened, and something surreal happened. It played huge. People were laughing. A lot. They got all the in-jokes about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Night Mother and Stella Dallas. I didn't even get the joke about Stella Dallas. When subservient Fritzy poisons Jill, Todd tapped me on the shoulder and whispered, "Get ready." Fritzy deadpans, "The goddamn show must go on," and the theater exploded in cheers. I felt electrified. I was just sitting in the audience, but my ears were ringing like I'd been struck by lightning. When the credits rolled, each character's face appeared for a moment, with the actor's name at the bottom of the screen. I gripped my seat, waiting for mine. My face came up, and again that electric feeling went through me. This was my name. I'm not sure I can explain this properly, but I was still expecting to see my character's name. This was my name. This was the name my mother called me, and my teachers called me, and the neighborhood kid who flashed his penis at me in the 5th grade had called me. Seeing it on film gave me that same feeling you get when you see yourself in the background of a photo you didn't know was being taken. I didn't feel especially proud or accomplished. If anything, it just reminded me what a dummy I was for being so surprised to be listed under my own name. But seriously, guys, holy shit. Then the strangest thing happened. The audience was on its feet for a movie with no real actors in it. For a movie about losers who sang show tunes. For a movie that looked like crap and had no production value. We went out and partied like only a group of dorky teens and young adults who've just had an incredible first screening of their weird movie could. That is to say, we crashed the Pieces of April party and drank them out of house and home. The next day, I got a call from a friend back home. At this point, Sundance was at the height of its unintentional rebranding from respected independent film festival to celebrity hangout. In fact, the following year, Paris Hilton showed up for no reason, which actually helped the backlash reach critical mass, and soon after, Sundance returned to being more about movies than celebrities. Although I'm told it won't ever be the same as it was in the 90s, we get it, Kevin Smith, it was real back then. My friend made small talk for a while, then said, "Hey, my mom was just watching Access Hollywood, and it said something about Britney Spears and Fred Durst being at Sundance right now. Isn't that weird? You're at something called Sundance, and then the Sundance with the famous people's going on at the same time. Did you know that?" "What? No, wait. What are you talking about? I'm at the Sundance." "What do you mean?" "I'm in a movie it's playing at the Sundance Film Festival right now." "Wait, really? Have you seen Britney Spears?" I had not seen Britney Spears, but this conversation recontextualized the underwhelming response I'd gotten in French class. They'd heard of the Sundance Film Festival, they just must have thought I meant something else. I suppose it would be like a coworker you'd known for years telling you they were about to compete in the Olympic trials. You'd assume they meant, like, the company Olympics and forget all about it. No, I haven't seen Britney Spears, but the movie got a standing ovation, which everyone says is really rare here, and I met Oliver Platt. Oh, Ross called Lauren S. to ask if they had biology homework for winter break, but she said that she saw him write down the assignment in class.
No.
Did Jenna dump him? Double life. James Bond. The movie came out and did not do well. The beauty and curse of Sundance is that the screenings are packed with film lovers, most of whom connect to the pain of being an outsider and get obscure references. They're also generous audiences for new talent. They forgave a lot of the film's flaws. Marketing the movie to the general public as a teen romp backfired enormously, and many people who thought they were going to see a musical American Pie were turned off by the homosexuality, cross-dressing, and vintage synthesizers. They were also less forgiving of the uneven quality of a low-budget film. Being in that theater at Sundance is one of the great memories of my career and maybe my life so far. But when I met a guy in London the following year who said the movie was boring and weird, I couldn't fault him. And when I met a girl 6 months ago who told me she named her car and her dog Fritzy, I made a mental note of her distinguishing features in case I had to describe her later for a police sketch. The mayor of Squaresville. I like to tell people that I'm a square. It's a charming way to warn someone that I'm a finicky little brat without freaking them out. I got to work with Lisa Kudrow recently, and when she told me she thought she was probably an even bigger square, I maintained that couldn't be true. We traded stories for a while, trying to out-straight-lace each other. For example, I told her about the time my friend found out I'd never seen a movie without paying, and he forced me to sneak into Iron Man. I did not enjoy the film at all. I felt guilty the entire time. And when I found myself at dinner with Jon Favreau and Robert Downey Jr. a year later, I confessed my crime and insisted on giving them cash or buying them something on the menu of commensurate value. Lisa knew she'd found an uptight, apple-polishing soul sister. We held a little election to see who would be the ruler of Squaresville if such a miraculous place existed. I was elected mayor and she, my loyal deputy. To be fair, the thing was rigged in our favor since we were the only two people organized enough to bother voting. I happen to love rules. I love having a plan. I love a film set that's run like a well-oiled machine. I thrive in structure. I drown in chaos. I love rules and I love following them. Unless that rule is stupid. And yes, I have felt qualified, no matter my age, to make that determination. Scrupulous people don't enjoy causing trouble, but they can be defiant as hell. As an adult, being square is a more or less acceptable personality trait. The only time I desperately wanted to be rebellious was in adolescence. I wanted to be Rizzo, not Sandra Dee. I had to will myself to break rules when I could stomach it. While I'll admit I enjoyed the thrill, I was not the bad kid. In fact, aside from the following stories, I was a painfully typical example of the good kid. During free period, even on the rare main sunny days, I'd stay in the cafeteria and do my Latin homework. Not because I was smart, but because I assumed the fabric of the universe would disintegrate if I didn't. But the qualities that made me a square as a teenager, dedication, independence, maturity, led me to break the biggest rule of all. I committed systematic genocide. Is she kidding? Listen on and find out. My adolescent flirtations with rule-breaking were alternately facilitated and foiled by my brother Mike. Mike was a genuine cool kid, not a popular kid. A wiry, quick-witted, slightly dangerous, well-liked kid. He'd been bullied in middle school, but at 15 he shot past 6 feet, got into good music and minor drug use, and stalked around the school in baggy white tees and fitted baseball hats. He had that feral look about him that was specific to the early 2000s, like the actors in the movie Kids, a movie I should not have watched before puberty. Like me, he had a strict sense of justice, so he had no interest in being unkind or intimidating people who were perfectly harmless. But he once beat up a friend for trying crystal meth and promised it would happen again if he slipped up. He was like a sheriff or an angsty Robin Hood. He'd be the first to point out what a loser I was, but he wouldn't let anyone else say a word against me. He once made a kid apologize to me after making a crack about my size. I didn't know you were Kendrick's sister. When I got home, Mike asked, "Did Spencer apologize to you today?" "Yeah, he did. And do you know what I said back?" "Dude, don't tell me. I know it's going to be something lame." It was something lame, so I'll spare him the embarrassment of putting it in this book. I got better grades than Mike, but only because, as every teacher said, he didn't apply himself. He eschewed all extracurricular activities in favor of hanging out in a park downtown that the local paper described as being full of undesirables. That wasn't a description of the unsavory types that my brother might find there. That was a description of my brother. He drove states away to go to raves, which he called parties, because only your parents and alarmed-looking blonde ladies from the news said raves. When people would call the house and ask, "Is Kendrick there?" I'd act irritated and say, "There are four Kendricks here. You'll have to be more specific." I always knew who they meant. I still idolized him. He still thought I was a liability at best and figured that dictating my social life was in everyone's best interest. At 13, I was invited to drink for the first time. Mike tore tickets at a local movie theater, and he and the rest of the teenage staff stayed behind after hours one night to throw a party. They had beer, vodka, and coffee brandy, a sickly sweet liqueur that you mix with milk. It's a staple of the low-income New England alcoholic, so naturally I started there. I wandered around the empty cinema discovering what a buzz felt like and hearing, "Hey, loser, you still good?" at 5-minute intervals. At 14, he let me smoke a bowl with him and his best friend Evan, whom I'd known since childhood. We went to TGI Fridays, and I said in a haze, "Hey, do you guys feel like we're in a movie?" They laughed at me. "Yeah, dude, that's the kind of stupid shit you need to get out of your system while you're just in front of us, rookie." That same year, he took me to my first party. That's rave, for all the people out there as lame as me. It was fun and weird, and I liked trying to pick up the dance style, though I might not have if I'd known how stupid I looked. I kept going whenever he would invite me, but mostly for the bragging rights. Mike told me I wouldn't be allowed to take ecstasy until I was 16, which was fine with me since I found navigating new environments hard enough when I was sober. When I was 15, we went separately to a warehouse rave upstate. I was paying for entry when a large young woman burst through the doors to the main floor, out into the makeshift lobby. She was still about 10 feet away when she pointed at me and said, "No, go home," and walked back inside. The guy who'd been taking my money shrugged and started to hand it back to me. If you're confused, it's because I mentioned that I was 15, so you pictured a 15-year-old. But at this point, I looked about 12. There weren't official age limits for a party thrown in a warehouse. Certainly 15 was old enough, yet she decreed I was too young. This would not stand. It had taken hours to get there, and more important, it was embarrassing. I paced away from the venue wondering what to do and scanned the small crowd of sweaty youths who'd come outside for air. I spotted a friend of Mike's. This wasn't hard. He knew everyone. "Hey, Travis, go find Mike. Tell him they won't let me in." 10 minutes later, my brother was outside and dragging me by the arm across the main floor. He planted me in front of the party's organizer. "Trish, this is my sister. She's 15. We good?" Trish took another look at me. "The age limit is 16. I'd never seen my brother's powers of persuasion falter before. "No, it isn't, dude. There's tons of kids in here who are 15. I'll bet you some are younger." "Yeah, but Mike, look at her. She looks like a baby. If she ODs at my party, imagine how her picture's gonna look in the paper. No one would ever rent a space to me again. Any 15-year-old that is in there at least had the decency to look like a degenerate." It was weird, but I kind of got her logic. "Well, you don't have to worry about that. She doesn't do drugs. I told her she can't try X until she's 16. Let her in." "In your face, lady." I'd just been described as a goody-two-shoes who left her drug-related decisions to her older brother, but I walked into the place looking like the smuggest little 12-year-old there ever was. Outside of underage substance use, my only dalliance in teen rule-breaking was some light shoplifting. Jesus, it's so trashy. It makes me cringe when I think of it. I visited a friend in New York the summer I turned 14, and she taught me. Oh, the city kids corrupting us weak-willed country folk. She also tried teaching me to flirt with guys, but soon found out that was asking too much. Basically, the trick to shoplifting was you went into a store, saw what you wanted, and took it without paying. Cute trick, right? Truthfully, the only thing she showed me was that it could be done. I think I would have gone my whole life without it occurring to me that normal people could just steal things. Pray I never witness a murder. The small mercy was that this phase was short-lived. I got a friend in my hometown to shoplift with me, you know, pay it forward and all that. And for a while, no Claire's or TJ Maxx was safe. But like a dying star, the desire burned brightly and disappeared quickly. A few years later, I told my mother that I'd gone through a short thievery phase. She was more surprised than angry. I suppose the statute of limitations for parental disapproval had passed. That weekend, as we wheeled our groceries out of the Hannaford, she realized we'd forgotten cereal. We went back in and I grabbed it while she started looking for the shortest checkout line. "Hey, Ma," I whispered. "You want me to just take it?" I cocked my head down and opened my winter coat. She looked scandalized, but kind of impressed, like I had a superpower, or we were on a date and I was the town bad boy. I put the cereal in the cart, but I swear, if I'd been serious, she would have let me do it. Weak-willed country folk. I remained a square, though. I had gone through the motions of a bare minimum teenage rebellion, but it was all very Olivia Newton-John learning to blow smoke rings. It was just a prelude to breaking the biggest rule of all. I started applying to colleges at the beginning of senior year. but I had this itch. I'd just come back from making camp, and I already had more high school credits than I needed, which made going to class feel like I was in a holding pattern. I happen to love learning, but clawing through layers of disruptive students and overstretched teachers and pointless extracurriculars to do it was discouraging. Deep down, I knew I didn't want to go to college. The idea of another 4 years of being chaperoned and dealing with immature classmates and putting off my real life made my chest tighten. But how could I not go? Everyone in my family went to college. Even my finally got his act together brother was in college. The value of education was ingrained in me from birth. In fact, I had thought college was mandatory until I was like 13 and saw a commercial for the Army. "I tried college. It wasn't for me," said the soldier. "Wasn't for you? What are you talking about? That's like saying paying your taxes wasn't for you." It turns out that was not correct. Yet once I'd learned college was optional, I still couldn't shake the sense that only lepers and the criminally insane didn't go. The itch was not going away. And even though I sent out my applications, I jumped at the first opportunity to put college on hold and start paying my dues. Fuck convention. Sandra D was going to the Big Apple. Leaving the Nest. A little night music. I graduated high school early so that I could move to Manhattan and do a little night music at New York City Opera, which is the braggiest sentence I will ever get to say. During this time, puberty finally hit me full force, which led to a number of horrifying incidents, including nearly passing out on stage because of the chest binder I had to wear to hide my new boobs. Renting an apartment on my own and going to work at Lincoln Center made me feel very grown up. I was constantly congratulating myself for the smallest things. Yeah, I'm just riding the subway to work in New York City like it's no big deal. Which of course meant that to me, at every moment, it was a huge deal. I wish I could say this masquerading as an adult and getting away with it feeling was exclusive to being 17, but so many things in my life are still like that. Yeah, I'm just checking my email on a laptop that I own like it's no big deal. Night music was the first real job I'd had since I was a kid, and I was desperate to do well. Also, Paul Gemignani, the musical director on High Society, who used to speed up that indulgent actress's songs, had recommended me for the role, and I didn't want to let him down. The cast was packed with impressive talent. My onstage grandmother and most frequent scene partner was played by none other than Claire Bloom, arguably the greatest living theater actress. Before I did the show, my dad found a VHS called Shakespeare's Women and Claire Bloom, which was half documentary, half masterclass. Watching it raised her to a godlike level in my eyes. Working with someone with that kind of technique was beyond intimidating. I wish I could say that I shouldn't have been nervous, but the woman did not mince words. During our first attempt to rehearse our most intimate scene in the show, Claire stopped me mid-sentence and said, "You're not going to do it like that, are you?" Well, Claire, I thought, this was my audition scene, and that was how I did it in my audition, which got me the job, so yeah, I thought I might. I never forgave the director for not defending me. Together, they decided what changes I should make. The net result was that I had to do almost the entire scene in profile, facing her. If she saw me outside the rehearsal room, she would ask to run our scenes over and over. She once snapped her fingers while I was midline and said, "No, really do it. Let's start again." As we got closer to the performance date, we started watching full run-throughs so we could see the pieces of the show come together. After watching me do a scene with another actor, Claire approached me and took hold of my arm. "That was really lovely work today, Anna," she said. Her eyes were sparkling. "No, I mean, really wonderful." I was thrilled, but something about the surprise in her voice made me feel like a monkey who'd composed a sonata. Still, it was enough to make me reframe her in my mind as a strict but fair mentor of sorts. We became almost friendly. We once walked to a Starbucks near Lincoln Center in the drizzling rain and didn't talk about work at all. I told her about my friends, who were still in high school back home, and how I missed them, but I never knew what to say when we talked. She talked a little bit about her ex-husband, who was Philip fucking Roth, by the way, and her daughter, and like a typical 17-year-old, I retained none of it. We were getting along well in spite of my fear, and she seemed to have a growing respect for my slightly superior musicianship. I could read music and follow time signature changes, which was especially important now that we were expected to listen for our cues instead of watching the conductor. The irony was that we were in the company of 5 full-time members of the New York City Opera, but their skill level so exceeded ours that we could almost no longer understand it to be impressive. It was like being the smartest janitor at NASA. Claire had a rich voice, and she acted the hell out of her songs, but she wasn't a confident musician, and not for nothing. Sondheim music is a damn battlefield. Our version of the show began with the curtain rising on a frozen tableau of the full cast. Claire's character sat before a wooden tray that was covered in playing cards and a brass handbell. I was seated on the floor by her feet, looking up at her. During the overture, Claire was meant to ring her bell to set all the characters in motion and begin the show. The cue had been a crapshoot during rehearsals, but in our final preview performance, she missed it by enough that our conductor stopped the music entirely and went back to the start. At the note session before opening night, our choreographer tentatively inquired if I could reach Claire's bell from where I was sitting in the opening tableau. I even more tentatively said yes. That settled that. We left the note session feeling a little awkward but relieved. I went up to the dressing room I shared with one of the New York City Opera members and started to get ready. Over the loudspeaker, I heard the announcement, "Anna Kendrick to Claire Bloom's dressing room. Anna Kendrick to Claire Bloom's dressing room." That phrase still haunts my dreams. I went down the four flights of stairs to her dressing room. She was set up in a solo room just off the stage, and I inched to her door. She had her back turned when I slithered in, but she looked up and saw me in her mirror. She did not turn around. I told them I'm ringing the bell. I'm ringing the bell, or I'm leaving the show. If I hadn't been terrified, I would have found this kind of fabulous. When it's time, you're going to cue me. Just give me a nod, and then I will ring the bell. Okay, I squeaked. I don't remember how I extricated myself, or if she had me stay a while and practice cueing her. But the image of her in that dressing room mirror and her mannered phrasing are permanently burned into my brain. When I told my parents the story, my dad was shocked. They just sent you to her dressing room? You're a minor! Why the hell would they have you settle a dispute with an adult actress on your own? It was a fair point in retrospect. I was happy to take all the criticism for even an ounce of praise, and if she ever reads this, I hope my reverence for her is clear. But just in case it's not, Claire, I worship you. If I saw you tomorrow and you hit me in the face, it would be the highlight of my year. She was the greatest living Shakespearean actress, and I was a 17-year-old in a bad wig. I'm not just mitigating this because she happens to still scare the crap out of me, but because people being tough with you doesn't always mean they're villains. Paul Gemignani kicked my ass on High Society, Little Night Music, and Into the Woods. And that dude loves me. Right, Paul? Moving to L.A. I was told as a child that if I wanted to be in entertainment, I shouldn't have a backup plan. That is terrible advice. If things hadn't worked out for me, I'd be an Uber driver or the world's most prudish porn star. Which doesn't mean I would be an unsuccessful porn star. There's a fetish for everything, ladies. However, I'm glad I followed that terrible advice. Don't get me wrong, I wish I had more skills. But if I'd had a safety net, I would have used it. Sometimes the terror was so overwhelming that if I'd been offered an apprenticeship scrubbing the floor of a button factory, what do normal jobs look like? I would have thought, fine, I can't take this anymore. Sign me up, give me the health benefits, and a time card, and a mean boss, and some goddamn security. I needed the fear. I needed to be forced to rely on myself, and the dream, and sometimes unemployment checks. Thank you, U.S. government. Please don't repossess my house when I go all Grey Gardens. It's obviously very lucky for me that, at the moment, acting is working out. This was not always the case. For a while there, if a casting director looked up from her clipboard, it was a good day. There are buildings in Los Angeles that still make me shudder when I drive past, the aura of rejection radiating off of them like a landfill on a hot day. I sometimes think I should have a sense of pride knowing that I achieved more than my 16-year-old brain would have ever let me imagine, but mostly it's just the opposite. I think self-doubt is healthy, and having to fight for the thing you want doesn't mean you deserve it any less. Maybe I'm not supposed to mention that it was a fight, but I find that to be such an old money attitude. I think I'm supposed to act as though I always knew I'd find success. Not out loud, obviously, just using some heavy-handed subtext. But moving to Los Angeles felt like that dream where you're naked in a grocery store hoping that no one will notice. I figured I'd be discovered and thrown out at some point. I'm still waiting. I came to L.A. without a car. I was unprepared for the move in a lot of ways, and thinking I could walk to a grocery store and back before a carton of milk spoiled was a pretty glaring one. Why didn't anyone tell me you needed a car in L.A.? Oh, because I didn't know a soul who lived there. That was a much greater problem, of course, but one thing at a time. Craigslist apparently existed back then, but no one I knew had ever heard of it, so I found an apartment the old-fashioned way, getting an email, six people removed, about a woman looking for a roommate. I crafted a few paragraphs about what a responsible, tidy, and courteous person I was and sent it to the woman in question. Gwendolyn was in her mid-20s, and although she was nervous about me being from out of town, she didn't want to babysit me. I assured her that I was very independent and I wouldn't rely on her while I got settled. After a couple of weeks of correspondence, once all the details had been worked out, I mentioned that I was 17 and see you in a few days. Can't wait! The day I arrived, Gwendolyn was cautious but very welcoming, and I made sure to do my very best impression of a capable human as proof that I wouldn't be a burden. That day, I bought the cheapest desk and twin bed that IKEA made. For good measure, I got a couple of those 99-cent tea light holders. I was taking Hollywood by storm and doing it in style. I'd only ever seen two neighborhoods in Los Angeles, so I didn't know what sketchy area I was living in. I ignored the fact that the corner store had bars in the windows and there were prostitutes outside at all hours. My gruff, disabled neighbor was clearly renting out the abandoned car in the garage to a homeless man, and the woman below me had night terrors, but I had candle holders, and I was going to be a goddamn actress. I'd been paid a decent amount for a failed TV pilot before I officially moved to LA, but when every cent you make has to last until your hypothetical next job, you don't get comfortable. I had to stretch that paycheck indefinitely, but alas, I needed a car. I bought a used Toyota and named him Charlie after Charlie Brown, because he broke down all the time. The next pilot season was starting up, which meant I was usually sent on 1 to 4 auditions a day. I discovered MapQuest and wrote down directions by hand since I didn't have a printer. Between that and my growing knowledge of the city, I was only getting lost like 6 times a day. Pilot season is grim because you're sent in for everything, no matter how wrong you are for it. I kept a mountain of clothes and accessories in my trunk so that I could go from the 14-year-old goth daughter on a TNT drama to the spoiled 22-year-old receptionist on a workplace comedy. It's obvious now that splitting my focus made it impossible for me to do well on any of them, but I was in no position to turn down auditions. How do I describe my personal life during this time? I met funny, interesting people. I went to art galleries downtown. I performed a one-woman show for free on a street corner, except none of that is true. I was alone and freaked out, and I stayed in my room a lot. I spent most of my time trying to find ways to occupy myself without spending money or ingesting calories. I didn't have any friends. Well, I didn't know anyone. Which is the less depressing way of saying I didn't have any friends. I didn't know how to make friends in LA. Usually when people move to a new city, it's for school or for work. Unlike my friends who were entering college, I was not surrounded by packs of like-minded young people, all equally eager to start new friendships. Unemployment and my lack of fake ID were conspiring to turn me into a world-class recluse. I managed to strike up a conversation with a girl in an audition waiting room once. She mentioned that she didn't have a ride home. Frankly, she seemed a little annoying, but I was desperate for human company, so I offered to drive her. Fingers crossed that she's not crazy. I immediately imagined telling people how my best friend and I might never have met if her car hadn't broken down that morning. Yeesh. Fingers crossed that I'm not crazy. In my car, I tried to play it cool. We made small talk. She said she'd grown up in LA, which made me doubly nervous. Then she rolled down the window, stuck her feet out, lit a cigarette, and changed the radio station. My new best friend was a real entitled bitch. I gave her my number when I dropped her off. She didn't offer hers in return. Some young neighbors invited me to a party they were having. When they collected $5 from everyone for pizza, I nervously told them I didn't have any cash, but I would pay them back the next day. In the morning, I knocked on their door with my $5, and they told me that someone had stolen the money. I assumed they suspected me. I'd been the only new person there. Did making a point to give my $5 make me look more or less guilty? They assured me they didn't think I'd done it, but I never spoke to them again. Does including the story in my book make me look more or less guilty? When I was nominated for an Independent Spirit Award for camp, I thought I might make friends with my fellow nominees. I also thought my parents would know what the Independent Spirit Awards were, but they've never been good at faking enthusiasm, so that phone call was disappointing. Whatever, this was gonna be great. I didn't know how publicists or stylists work, but I figured if you walked into a store at the Beverly Center Mall and talked loudly about how you needed an outfit for a fancy award show, they'd offer you something eventually. That didn't happen, but no worries, Anna. You're substance, not style. Just focus on the art. I watched all the films from my category, some of which were not easy to track down. I thought this would facilitate conversation, but it ended up making me look like a superfan. I assumed my fellow emerging artists would have done their research as well. I guess they were busy effortlessly fitting in. I tried to keep in touch with my friends from home. People I'd known since childhood were scattered at colleges around the country, but they all seemed to be having the same euphoric experience. I would call them and feel destroyed by loneliness. It was almost comical. Me sitting on my bed, trying not to disturb my adult roommate, as someone told me how amazing everything was and their new friends called out for them in the background. They had the next 4 years of their lives mapped out for them, and I was pretending I didn't see the homeless man asleep in the cart next to mine. I remember hearing somewhere that people misremember their adolescence as entirely wonderful, or more often, entirely awful, when it's probably some combination of the two. My memory of my early time at LA suffers from this syndrome. The first year was tough. I was lonely, I was broke, but things went from soul-crushing to tolerable in one evening. A friend of mine who was passing through LA took pity on me. He invited me to an American Idol viewing party with some of his friends. Most of the people there didn't know each other, and I bonded with two dudes named Peter and Alex over our shared outrage when Jennifer Hudson was kicked off. We started hanging out almost nonstop. After a few weeks, Peter and Alex mentioned that they both happened to be apartment hunting. I awkwardly said, "Can I come too?" I think they were more than happy to have a girl around to make it clear that they were not dating. They were gay, in case the indignation over J-Hud's dismissal from Idol didn't tip you off. They just weren't dating each other. I told Gwendolyn via email and with minimal notice that I would be moving out. You know, like a coward. At that point, I'd already been unmasked as a non-responsible, non-tidy, non-courteous person, so what did I have to lose? I disassembled my desk and bed and reassembled them in a three-bedroom apartment in West Hollywood. That moving day was glorious. I was 18 and I was living with two dudes in an apartment with new carpet. I took the smallest bedroom so I could pay $50 less a month. The fact that it had only one very small window gave the room a minimum security prison vibe. But we made a group trip to IKEA, and this time I bought the second cheapest dresser they made to class the place up. The first week we lived there, Alex and I woke up to find tar tracked through the living room carpet. Peter had drunkenly stepped through a construction site, and wouldn't you know it, tar does not come out of carpet. Ever. I was pissed at Peter, but he was so lovable he got away with everything. It made the whole place look dingy, and I had to nervously explain it away when I had anyone over. But we decided we'd rather lose the security deposit than pay to recarpet, so I attempted to hide the stain with an area rug. That decision essentially doomed the apartment to remain in its squalid state. But we figured we'd probably move in a year or so. Alex and I were both under 21, but Peter was of age and graciously bought alcohol for us. To save money on decor, we exclusively drank Sky Vodka and artfully arranged the empty blue bottles in our living room. I hate day drinking now, possibly because it reminds me of this period. I think we drank just to feel like we were doing something. For the most part, we had fun. We went to Dragnet at Mickey's and someone dressed as my character from camp, which made me feel more like a superstar than I ever have since. We got stoned and watched scary movies. I smoked too much the night we watched the Amityville Horror and climbed up the back of the couch begging the boys to stop reading my thoughts. It wasn't a great look, but this was the stuff that distracted me from the overwhelming uncertainty of my professional life. A friend who worked for a catering company would occasionally need a temp last minute, pay me cash under the table, and let me have all the tuna niçoise I could eat. But most of the time I was praying that Law & Order would need a mousy little teen killer so I could keep paying my car insurance. Because Peter had lived in L.A. the longest and was old enough to go out at night, Alex and I became close. At first out of convenience and then out of a genuine shared love of making fun of everything and everyone, most of all each other. We watched pop concerts on DVD. We tried to take edgy photographs of each other on my 3-megapixel camera. We discovered the casual encounter section of Craigslist and, naturally, posted an erotic plea to meet up in the bushes at the end of our street. We waited outside until two guys showed up and walked off together. We were like the creepy cupids of anonymous sex. Brazen little beasts that we were, Alex and I were not satisfied with just drinking in our apartment. We wanted to drink with the rest of the world. At that time, clubs were the pinnacle of Los Angeles nightlife. Maybe they still are, and I'm just out of touch. Unlike bars, these clubs were large and open and played their music at horrifying volumes. I didn't know what went on in them, but I wanted to find out. Alex knew a mysterious figure named Carlos who seemed to treat going out with the same urgency and focus as a mission from Homeland Security. The more I learned about LA nightlife, the more it seemed like a full-time job. Any decent subculture can sell you the promise that reaching the top of its hierarchy means you've accomplished something, and clubbing was no different. You went to the right club on the right night, which is to say you only went to the hardest clubs to get into on the very hardest nights to get in. You spent all day primping and pre-gaming, and all evening enjoying the fruits of your labor. One night, Carlos asked us to meet him at Element, a name that inspired some reverence from Alex and consequently from me. We had to get in. We nervously explained to Carlos that while Alex had a fake ID, I did not. Carlos wasn't worried. He told us to come anyway. I assumed he was going to sneak us through some back exit, but when we arrived, he walked straight toward the bouncer. Barely breaking his stride, Carlos said, "She's Ashley's best friend," and kept walking, dragging us behind him. "Who's Ashley?" I asked. "Ashley Olsen. I told the owner she's coming by tonight. She's not." I was not yet 21, and neither was Ashley Olsen, yet her name had gotten a stranger through the door of a nightclub without question. The mention of fame in any form, even underage fame, cloaked me from suspicion. Personally, I was thrilled to hear the promise of her attendance was a ruse. I imagine if Miss Olsen had arrived, I would have been thrown at her feet like the peasant I am and dragged out of the club. The inside looked like a minimalist parody of itself. It was just a dark, empty space with black boxes laid out in different formations, serving as tables or chairs. The music was blaring. "Why isn't anyone dancing?" I shouted. If this had been the TV version of my life, a character would have explained to me that you don't dance, you just stand around looking cool. Unfortunately, people don't explain things like that in real life. They want you to shut up and blend in until you figure it out. Luckily for Carlos, the music was so loud that he could reasonably pretend he hadn't understood me and trot away toward someone more interesting. Alex and I were left standing by ourselves. He seemed to immediately understand that we'd stumbled into some inner circle and playing along was the name of the game. I continued shouting. I don't get it! There's all this space and the music is too loud to have a conversation, but we're not supposed to dance? Are you just supposed to stand around looking at each other? Alex was trying to telepathically communicate, yes, asshole, you are, okay? I kept going. Do they have the music this loud because no one in Los Angeles has anything to say to each other? I thought constantly making fun of LA made me look smart. Alex ignored me and eventually I got the message that if I was so annoyed by the situation, I was free to leave. Sadly, the truth is I was equally under the spell of the nightlife mythos. It didn't matter if you weren't having fun. You pretended that you were and bragged about it later. I wanted to do the bragging bit, so I shut my mouth and stayed. For a while, Alex and I engaged with the nightclub culture as frequently as we could. My interest in getting into these clubs didn't last long. It would vanish completely after my 21st birthday because, like guys who play hard to get, or Tickle Me Elmo, or your first period, sometimes you only want a thing until you have it. But at 19, I did spend a short and regrettable period in a classic trap, trying to fit into something I hated just to prove to myself that I could. Once I realized, to my great relief, that Hollywood party girl was something I was not destined to be, I found increasingly joyous ways to spend my time. Instead of privately obsessing over them, I forced Peter to help me rehearse audition scenes. The terrible roles were far more fun and more frequent than the good ones. The horror scenes were especially good fodder, and we'd end up screaming bloody murder and chasing each other around the apartment. It's weird that I never got those roles. When some of my California native friends heard I'd never been to Disneyland, they insisted on taking me that very moment, even though it was pissing rain. We ran around the park, soaking wet, but almost completely alone. I started teaching myself to bake. I went to an unreasonable number of costume parties. Why did my friends throw so many costume parties? I rediscovered my favorite things, long walks and great movies, and eventually the darkness and power that I'd projected onto the city started to dissipate. I hadn't booked a job or improved my financial situation, but I was going to be okay. Then a funny thing happened. I started getting calls from the same friends from my hometown, the ones who'd been adapting so well to college, now in the first months of their sophomore year. Back at school again, they were no longer overwhelmed by the newness or possibility. They'd gone back to the same place, the same friends, some of whom they had made hastily. And now they were lost. It was fine to be the freshman who hadn't declared a major, but now they had no idea what they wanted to do with their lives or what kind of person they wanted to be, and they were feeling the pressure to decide fast. The role reversal was uncanny. I hadn't even booked a job yet, but somehow we'd switched places. I was convinced that I was on the right path, and they were riddled with uncertainty. I'd only been looking at the drawbacks of my situation. My single-mindedness meant that I had no backup plan. I was worried that if I failed, I'd be unhappy doing anything else. But now I saw this as a blessing. I knew what I wanted. I'd never considered how scared I would be if I didn't. That year, Felicity Huffman won an award for her work in Transamerica and said something in her acceptance speech that I held onto for years. The second time I didn't work for a year, I gave up any dream that looked like this. It knocked me sideways. This undeniably talented woman went years without getting a job, not because she wasn't good, but because sometimes you just have to pass an endurance test. I worried that luck and timing and opportunity and my little frame and goofy face might never align at the right moments, but for all the inexorable insecurities that live inside my head, I knew what I was capable of. I just had to be patient. I did get work eventually. I acted in a few independent films that made me happier than I thought humanly possible, but they didn't change my financial situation or keep me all that busy, so I had to develop some hobbies. My biggest time waster and unrepentant money suck was baking. Baking provided something I didn't know I needed. The ability to make something tangible. Actors don't make anything. You work all day, but there's nothing physical to show for it. It's an oversimplification, sure, but it felt so rewarding to put a little effort into something and have three-dimensional evidence I could hold in my hands. It also provided more of a thing I've always liked, validation. Baking is a really fun way to get people to like you. Being a good listener, a lively conversationalist, a loyal friend, it takes so much energy. Spend a couple hours alone in your kitchen and get the same effect? Sign me up. Sadly, I have less time for it now, but for a couple years, it was my whole identity. When I was in the throes of my baking phase, my oven broke, and luckily, different friends were happy to host me for a few hours and let me fill their apartments with the smell of cinnamon while I refused to let them help because you don't know the system! I saw baking as a risk-free way to try things that I knew were beyond my skill level. I was never the girl to strap on a snowboard and head straight for a black diamond, but if I saw Advanced in the corner of a Martha Stewart Living recipe, I'd think, bring it on, you crazy bitch. This meant I would sometimes spend hours in someone else's home, experimenting and cursing and emerging from the kitchen looking like I'd fought off a rabid cat. But my hazelnut tort would be shining and beautiful, and I'd go pawn it off on someone who hadn't seen behind the curtain and would praise me as a culinary genius. One friend in particular liked having me come by. Scott wrote music during the day, but he didn't like being alone. He wanted someone around to chat with for a few minutes every hour or so, but then he needed to sit in front of his computer with headphones on to get work done. It became a semi-regular arrangement. After about a year of this, he told me he'd gotten off meth a month ago. What? What was he talking about? Meth addicts were gaunt and toothless, their hair was stringy and their nails were dirty, and they certainly didn't burn me indie rock CDs. How could a friend of mine been in this kind of trouble without me noticing? I felt so foolish and so, so guilty. He was out of the woods and sober ever since, thank God. But really, what kind of friend was I? So, you just do it as soon as I left your apartment? I mean, were you ever like, she needs to get out of here because I need to do meth? No. He looked a little embarrassed, maybe more for me than himself. I would do it before you got there. I've seen you on meth? I would say for the last year you've only seen me on meth. I am the biggest idiot on the planet. Yeah, I didn't like being alone, but then I just wanted to sit on my own and work once you got there. You really never noticed? I thought that was just your personality! I was reeling. Why do you think I never wanted to eat the food you were making? You said you didn't have a sweet tooth, and I believed you! Because, you know, I believe people when they say things! He was laughing now. I'd gotten shrill and frazzled. I was laughing with my friend about how he was hiding a meth problem from me. This is when I learned I cannot tell when people are on drugs. At all. After a while, I met some fellow aspiring actors, which was nice because they were the only people in L.A. who didn't crack the old, so you mean you're a waiter joke, when the what do you do question came up. Every now and then we get stoned and talk about our silliest, most specific goals. I want the and credit, someone would start. You know, at the end of a bunch of credits, sometimes there'll be a with or an and. Obviously, I want to be the lead and get first billing or whatever, but someday I want to be the and guy. Oh, I said. I want to be the is a revelation, like in the Brokeback Mountain trailer when they show Michelle Williams and the voiceover guy reads a review like, Williams is a revelation. I want to be a revelation. That's a good one. Maybe I want that. No, I want to be the secret post-credits cameo. Most of my friends were not actors. A surprising percentage were just my neighbors. I became close with a group of stunning girls who lived in a duplex down the street. Paige was a model, Amy was an exotic dancer, and Valerie was a former exotic dancer whose wealthy boyfriend paid her bills and rent. They'd met during a lap dance. It was a true L.A. love story. The girls were beautiful, hilarious, and tough as steel. On the night we met, Valerie, through her thick Queens accent, said, "You're smart, right? You know how I know you're smart? 'Cause I would have copied off of you in high school." I liked hanging out with them. These ladies could party, and being with a group of girls that bombastic made me the quiet one. I was their mousy, serious friend, and I happily leaned into the role. Surrounding myself with people who were so much more attractive than me meant I could feel like the substantial one. I wouldn't call it healthy, but I did it anyway. They also had a talent for getting into and out of trouble. The cops showed up at their house once because of a noise complaint, and I swear on my life, they turned up the music, ran into the street, got in a cop car, and danced with the officers until they went away. In the rain. We went to Vegas and Palm Springs. We went to the Spearmint Rhino in downtown L.A. after eating some especially potent pot brownies and watched Amy do what can only be described as an erotic Cirque du Soleil routine. When Valerie's boyfriend came into town, he'd rent out a suite at the Chateau Marmont, and we'd all get drunk and choreograph fake music videos to every song on my iPod. They got me out of the house, which was no easy feat, and no matter how hard I struggled, they forced me to occasionally have fun. I still hadn't had a boyfriend yet, though, and I realized this was unacceptably weird. 19-year-olds had boyfriends, damn it. They had boyfriends. They had ex-boyfriends. Most of them had multiple ex-boyfriends. I bought a book called Guide to Getting It On and prepared to get it over with. Outside of romance, my real life was coming together, slowly but surely. It didn't look like how I'd once thought it should. I couldn't afford Crate and Barrel plates, my ultimate idea of status. Related, did you know there are fancier places than Crate and Barrel to get plates? The jobs I was getting were low budget and almost willfully not mainstream. My friends weren't polished, but neither was I. It was so much better. Boys. boys and the terror of being near them. I read somewhere that the reason adolescent girls are attracted to androgynous young men is that they seem less threatening. Since their sexuality is not fully realized yet, they feel safer placing attraction on boys with thin frames and delicate features because it subconsciously reminds them of another girl. They don't have to confront the implications of being attracted to someone masculine and virile enough to, you know, do it.